I'm on vacation, Hetar said dryly. Urgot grinned.
We are not going to be unpleasant to each other, are we?
He asked, still slightly apprehensive.
No, Your Majesty, Hetar told him. I don't think we are. For some reason, you intrigue me.
Well, that's a relief,
Urgot said.
If you find yourself getting edgy, though, be sure to let me know. There are still a dozen or so of my father's generals lurking about the Drojum. Oskatat has not found a reason to have them beheaded yet. I'll send for them and you can settle your nerves. They're just a bother to me anyway.
He frowned.
I wish I'd known you were coming, he said. I've wanted to send your father a present for years now.
Hetar looked at him, one eyebrow raised.
He did me the greatest service any man can ever do for another. He ran his saber through Tar Urgus's guts. You might tell him that I tidied up for him afterward.
Oh? My father does not usually need to be tidied up after.
Oh, Tar Urgus was dead enough, all right, Urgot assured him. But I did not want some Grolem to come along and accidentally resurrect him, so I cut his throat before we buried him.
Cut his throat?
Even Hetar seemed startled by that.
Ah, from ear to ear, Urgot said happily. I stole a little knife when I was about 10, and I spent the next several years sharpening it. After I slit his weasand, I drove a stake through his heart and buried him 17 feet deep, head down. He looked better than he had in years with his feet sticking up out of the dirt. I paused to enjoy that sight while I was resting from all of that shoveling.
You buried him yourself?
Beric asked.
I certainly wasn't going to let anybody else do it. I wanted to be sure of him. After I had him well planted, I stampeded horses across his grave several times to conceal the spot. As you may have guessed, my father and I were not on the best of terms. I take some pleasure in knowing that not a single living Murgo knows exactly where he is buried. Why don't we go join my queen and my mother? Then you can tell me your splendid news, whatever it is. Dare I hope that Kalzakath rests in the arms of Torak?
I wouldn't think so.
Oh, pity, Urgot said.
As soon as they found out that Polgra, Tsenedra, and Velvet were still on board Seabird, Queen Prala and Queen Mother Tamazin excused themselves and left the throne room to renew old acquaintances.
Fine seats, gentlemen,
Urgot said after they had left. He sprawled on his throne with one leg cocked up over the arm.
What are these things you wanted to tell me, Keldar?
Silk sat down on the edge of the dais and reached inside his tunic.
Please don't do that, Keldar,
Urgot told him, shying away.
I know how many daggers you carry.
Not a dagger this time, Urgot, Silk assured him. Only this. He handed over a folded parchment packet. Urgot opened it and scanned it quickly.
Who is Alderin of Perivor?
He asked. He's the king of an island off the south coast of Meloria, Geryon told him. A group of us met in his palace.
Quite a group, I see, Urgot said,
looking over the signatures. He frowned.
I also see that you spoke for me, he said to Silk.
He protected your interests rather well, Urgot,
Belgarath assured him.
The details we hammered out are mostly generalities, you will notice, but it is a start.
It is indeed, Belgarath,
Urgot agreed.
I noticed that no one spoke for Drosta.
The king of Gorognadrak was unrepresented, Your Majesty,
Mandorallan told him.
Poor old Drosta, Urgot chuckled. He always seems to get left out. This is all very nice, gentlemen, and it might even ensure a decade or so of peace, provided you promise to let Zakath have my head on a plate to decorate some unimportant room in his palace at Malzeth with.
That's the main thing we came to discuss with you, Silk told him. Zakath returned to Malzeth when we all left Perivor. but I talked with him for quite a while before we separated, and he finally agreed to accept some peace overtures.
Peace?
Urgot scoffed.
The only peace Sakath wants is eternal peace, for every living Murgo, and I am at the top of his list.
He has changed a bit, Geryon told him. He has something more important on his mind right now than exterminating Murgos.
Nonsense, Geryon. Everybody wants to exterminate the Murgos. Even I want to exterminate them, and I'm their king.
Send some ambassadors to Malzeth, Silk advised him. Give them enough power to negotiate in good faith.
Give a Murgo power? Keldar, are you out of your mind?
I can find some trustworthy men, Urgot,
Oskatat assured him.
In Tol Murgos? Where? Under some damp rock?
You're going to have to start trusting people, Urgot, Belgarath told him.
Oh, of course, Belgarath,
Urgot said with heavy sarcasm.
I sort of have to trust you, but that's because you'll turn me into a frog if I don't.
Just send your ambassadors to Melzeth, Urgot, Silk said patiently. You may be pleasantly surprised at the outcome.
Any outcome that does not leave me without my head would be pleasant.
Urgot squinted shrewdly at his brother.
You have got something else on your mind, Keldar. Go ahead and spit it out.
The world's right on the verge of breaking out. In a bad case of peace, Silk told him. My partner and I have been on a wartime footing for years now. Our enterprises are very likely to collapse if we don't find new markets, and markets for peacetime goods. Tol Murgos has been at war for a generation now.
Longer than that, actually. Technically, we have been at war since the ascension of the Urgot dynasty, which I have the distinct displeasure of representing.
There must be quite a hunger for peacetime amenities in your kingdom, then. Little things like roofs for the houses, pots to cook in, something to cook in them, things like that.
I'd imagine so, yes.
Good. Yarblik and I can ship goods to Tol Murgos by sea and turn Rakarga into the largest commercial center on the southern half of the continent.
Why would you want to? Tol Murgos is bankrupt.
The bottomless mines are still there, aren't they?
Of course, but they are all in territories controlled by the Malorians.
But if you conclude a peace treaty with Sakath, the Malorians will be leaving, won't they? We'll have to move fast on this, Urgot. As soon as the Malorians withdraw, you'll have to move in, not only with troops, but also with miners.
What do I get out of it?
Taxes, brother mine, taxes. You can tax the gold miners, you can tax me, and you can tax my customers. You'll be rolling in money in just a few years.
And the Tonedrans will swindle me out of all of it in just a few weeks.
Not too likely, Silk smirked. Varana's the only Tonedrin in the world who knows about this, and he's on Barak's ship out in the harbor right now. He won't get back to Tol Honnoth for several weeks.
What difference does that make? Nobody can make a move of any kind until I conclude a peace treaty with Sakath, can they?
That's not entirely true, Urgot. You and I can draw up an agreement guaranteeing me exclusive access to the Murgo market. I'll pay you handsomely for it, of course. And the agreement will be perfectly legal and ironclad. I've drawn up enough trade agreements to be able to see to that. We can hammer out the details later, but the important thing right now is to get something down in writing with both our names on it. And then, when peace breaks out, the Tonedurans will swarm down here. You can show them the document and send them all home again. If I've got exclusive access, we'll make millions. Millions, Urgot. Millions. Both of their noses were twitching violently now.
What sort of provisions would we want to put in this agreement of exclusivity?
Urgot asked cautiously. Silk grinned broadly at him and reached inside his doublet again. I've taken the liberty of drawing up an interim document, he said, pulling out another parchment.
Just to save time, of course. Stithis Tor was still a very unattractive city, Geryon noticed as Berak's sailors moored seabird to the familiar wharf in the Drasnian trade enclave. The hawsers were no sooner tied off than Silk leaped across to the wharf and hurried up the street.
"Is he likely to have any trouble?" Geryon asked Tsadi.
"Not too likely," Tsadi, who was crouched down behind a longboat, replied. "Salmisra knows who he is, and I know my queen. Her face doesn't show any emotion, but her curiosity is very strong. I've spent the last 3 days composing that letter. She'll see me. I can practically guarantee that. Could we go below, Geryon? I'd really rather not have anybody see me."
It was perhaps 2 hours later when Silk returned, accompanied by a platoon of Nyssen soldiers. The platoon leader was familiar.
"Is that you, SS?" Sadi called out through the porthole of the cabin in which he was hiding. "I thought you would be dead by now."
"Hardly," the one-eyed assassin said.
"You are working at the palace now?"
"Yes."
"For the queen?"
"Among others. I take on a few odd jobs for Javelin now and then."
"Does the queen know about that?"
"Of course. All right, Sadi. The queen's agreed to a 2-hour amnesty for you. I'm sure you'll want to be gone from here before those 2 hours run out. The queen's fangs start to itch every time she hears your name. So let's go. Unless you'd like to reconsider and start running right now."
"No," Tsadi said. "I'll be right up. I'm bringing Polgara and Belgarion with me, if that's all right."
"That's up to you," Isis said with an indifferent shrug.
The palace was still infested with snakes and with dreamy-eyed eunuchs. A pimply-faced official with broad hips and a grotesquely made-up face met them at the palace door.
"Well, Sadi," he said in a piping soprano voice, "I see you've returned."
"And I see you've managed to stay alive, Yisthith," Sadi replied coldly. "That's a shame, really."
Yisthith's eyes narrowed with an undisguised hatred.
"I'd be a little careful about what I say, Sadi," he squeaked. "You're not chief eunuch anymore. As a matter of fact, I may soon hold that position myself."
"May the heavens defend poor Nyssa, then," Tsadi murmured.
"You've heard of the queen's command that Sadi be given safe conduct?" Isis asked the eunuch.
"Not from her own lips."
"Salmisra does not have lips, is it? And you've just heard about it from me. Now, are you going to get out of our way? Or am I going to have to slit you up the middle?"
Yisthis backed away.
"You can't threaten me, SS."
"I wasn't threatening you. I was just asking a question."
Then the assassin led the way up the polished stone corridor, leading to the throne room. The room they entered was unchanged and probably unchangeable. Thousands of years of tradition had seen to that. Salmisra, her coils stirring restlessly, and her blunt, crowned head weaving sinuously in front of her mirror, occupied the throne.
"Tsadi the eunuch, my queen," Issus announced with a bow.
Issus, Geryon noted, did not prostrate himself before the throne as did other Nyssens.
"Ah," Salmisra hissed. "And the beautiful Palgra. And King Belgarion. You have fallen in with important people since you left my service, Tsadi."
"Pure chance, my queen," Tsadi lied glibly.
"What is this vital matter that impelled you to risk your life by coming into my presence again?" "Only this, eternal Salmisra,"
Tzadi replied. He set his red leather case on the floor, opened it, and removed a folded parchment. He casually kicked a groveling eunuch in the ribs. "Take this to the queen," he commanded.
"You are not enhancing your popularity here, Tzadi," Geryon cautioned quietly.
"I'm not running for public office, Geryon. I can be as disagreeable as I choose to be."
Salmisra quickly perused the Accords of Dalperavor.
"Interesting," she hissed. "I'm sure your majesty can see the opportunities implicit in those accords," Tzadi said. "I felt it was my responsibility to make you aware of them."
"Of course I can see what is involved, Tzadi," she said. "I'm a snake, not a cretin."
"Then I'll bid you goodbye, my queen. I have performed my last duty to you."
Salmisra's eyes had gone flat with concentration.
"Not just yet, my Tzadi,"
she said in a whisper that was almost a purr.
"Come a little closer."
"You gave your word, Salmisra," he said apprehensively.
"Oh, do be sensible, Tzadi. I'm not going to bite you. It was all a ploy, wasn't it? You had discovered the possibility that these accords might be in the making, and you deliberately set out to have yourself disgraced so that you could pursue them. Your negotiations on my behalf were brilliant, I must say. You have done very well, Tzadi, even if your actions involve deceiving me. I am well pleased with you. Would you consent to resume your former position here in the palace?"
"Consent, my queen?" he blurted almost boyishly. "I'd be overjoyed. I live but to serve you."
Salmisra swiveled her head around to regard the prostrated eunuchs.
"You will all leave me now," she commanded them. "I want you to go throughout the palace and spread the word that Tzadi has been rehabilitated and that I have reinstated him. If anyone cares to dispute my decision, send him to me, and I'll explain it to him."
They stared at her, and Geryon noticed that not a few faces were filled with chagrin.
"How tiresome,"
Salmisra sighed.
"They are too delighted to move. Please, drive them out, Issus."
"As my queen desires," Issus said, drawing his sword. "Did you want them all to survive?"
"A few of them, Issus. The more nimble ones."
The throne room was vacated almost immediately.
"I cannot sufficiently thank your majesty," Tzadi said.
"I'll think of a way, my Tzadi. First of all, we'll both pretend that the motives I suggested a moment ago were genuine, won't we?"
"I understand perfectly, divine Salmisra."
"After all," she added, "we must protect the dignity of the throne. You will assume your former duties and your former quarters. We'll think of suitable honors and rewards later."
She paused.
"I have missed you, my Tzadi. I don't think anyone can ever know how much."
Her head moved slowly around, and she regarded Polgara.
"And how did your encounter
with Zandramos go, Polgara?
She asked.
Zandramos is no longer with us, Salmisra. Splendid. I never really liked her. And is the universe restored again?
It is, Salmisra.
I think I'm glad of that. Chaos and disruption are irritating to a snake, you know. We're partial to calm and to order.
Geryon noticed that a small green snake had slithered out from under Salmisra's throne to approach Tzadi's red leather case, which lay open and forgotten on the marble floor. The little snake reared up to regard the earthenware bottle. He was purring seductively.
And did you recover your son, your majesty?
Salmisra asked Geryon.
We did, your majesty.
Congratulations. Give my regards to your wife.
I will, Salmisra.
We must leave now, Polgara said.
Goodbye, Tzadi.
Goodbye, Lady Polgara.
Tzadi looked at Geryon.
Goodbye, Geryon. It has been a lot of fun, hasn't it?
Yes, it has,
Geryon agreed, shaking the eunuch's hand.
Say goodbye to the others for me. I rather imagine we will see each other from time to time on state business. But it won't be exactly the same, will it?
No, probably not.
Geryon turned to follow Aunt Paul and Essus from the throne room.
A moment, Polgara,
Salmisra said.
Yes.
You have changed many things here. At first, I was very angry with you. But now I've had time to reconsider. Everything's turned out for the best, after all. You have my thanks.
Polgara inclined her head.
Congratulations on your forthcoming blessing,
Salmisra added. Polgara's face gave no hint of surprise at the Serpent Queen's perception of her condition.
Thank you, Salmisra, she said.
They stopped off in Tol Hanath to deliver Emperor Varana to the palace. The heavy-shouldered professional soldier seemed a bit abstracted, Geryon noticed. He spoke briefly with a palace functionary as the group moved toward his quarters, and the officials scurried away. Their farewells were brief, almost abrupt. Varana was, as always, the soul of courtesy, but he obviously had other things on his mind. Synedra was fuming as they left the palace. She was, as she almost always was now, carrying her young son and was absently running her fingers through his blonde curls.
He was almost rude,
she said indignantly. Silk looked down the broad marble drive leading up to the palace. Spring was approaching in these northern latitudes, and the leaves were beginning to appear on the huge old trees lining the drive. A number of richly dressed Tolnedrans was almost running up the drive toward the palace.
Your uncle, your brother, whichever you want to call him, has something very important to attend to just now, the little man told Synedra.
What could possibly be more important than common courtesy?
Tolmurgos at the moment.
I don't understand.
If Sakath and Urgot work out a peace treaty, there will be all sorts of commercial opportunities in Tolmurgos.
I understand that,
she said tartly.
Of course you do. You are a Tolnedren, after all.
Why aren't you doing something about it?
I already have, Synedra,
he smiled, polishing a large ring on the front of his pearl-gray doublet.
Varana may be very cross with me when he finally finds out what I've done to him.
What exactly did you do?
I'll tell you, once we're back out to sea. You are still a Baroon, and you might have some residual family loyalties. I wouldn't want you to spoil the surprise for your uncle. They sailed north, along the west coast, and then up the River Erend to the shallows a few leagues west of Vomimbre. Then they took a horse and rode through the spring sunshine to the fabled city of the Mimbrate Erends. The court of King Coradulin was thunderstruck by Mandoralan's announcement that Mimbrate Erends had been discovered on the far side of the world. Courtiers and functionaries were sent scurrying off to various libraries to compose suitable replies to the greetings sent from King Olduran. The copy of the Accords of Dal Perevor, delivered to the throne by Lalduran, however, evoked troubled expressions on the faces of several of the more seasoned members of the court.
"I do fear me, your majesties,"
one elderly courtier observed to Coradulin and Maeserina,
"that our poor Arendia hath once more fallen behind the rest of the civilized world. Always in the past have we taken some comfort in the well-nigh eternal strife between Elrond and Angrag, and the more recent conflict between Melorian and Murko, thinking perhaps that their discord in some measure excused ours. This scant comfort, methinks, will not be available to us. Shall we let it be said that only in the most tragic of kingdoms doth rancor and rude war still prevail? How may we hold up our heads in a peaceful world so long as childish bickering and idiotic intestine war do mar our relationships with each other? I find our words highly offensive, my lord," a stiff-necked young baron denounced the old man. "No true Mimbrite could ever refuse to heed the stern urgings of honor."
"I speak not of Mimbrites only, my lord," the old man replied mildly. "I speak of all Erends, Asturians as well as Mimbrites."
"Asturians have no honor," the baron sneered.
Walderan immediately went for his sword. "Nay, my young friend," Mandoralan said, restraining the impetuous youth. "The insult hath been delivered here on Mimbrite soil. Thus it is my responsibility and pleasure to answer it." He stepped forward.
"Thy words were perhaps hasty, my lord," he said politely to the arrogant baron. "I pray thee, reconsider them."
"I have said what I have said, Sir Knight," the young hothead declared.
"Thou hast spoken discourteously to a revered counselor of the king," Mandoralan said firmly. "And thou hast delivered a mortal insult unto our brethren of the north."
"I have no Asturian brethren," the knight declared. "I do not deign to acknowledge kinship with miscreants and traitors."
Mandoralan sighed.
"I pray thee forgive me, your majesty," he apologized to the king. "Mayhap thou wouldst have the ladies withdraw, for I propose to speak bluntly."
No force on earth, however, could have dragged the ladies of the court from the throne room at that time. Mandoralan turned back toward the insolently sneering baron.
"My lord," the great knight said distantly, "I find thy face ape-like, and thy form misshapen. Thy beard, moreover, is an offense against decency, resembling more closely the scabrous fur which doth decorate the hinder portion of a mongrel dog than a proper adornment for a human face. Is it possible that thy mother, seized by some wild lechery, did dally at some time past with a randy goat?"
The baron went livid, and he spluttered, unable to speak.
"Thou seemeth wroth, my lord," Mandoralan said to him, in that same deceptively mild tone. Or mayhap thine unseemly breeding hath robbed thy tongue of human speech. He looked critically at the baron. I do perceive, my lord, that thou art afflicted with cowardice as well as lack of breeding, for in truth no man of honor would endure such deadly insult as those which I have delivered unto thee without some response. Therefore I fear I must goad thee further. He removed his gauntlet. As all the world knew, it was customary to hurl one's gauntlet to the floor when issuing a challenge. Mandarallan somehow missed the floor. The young baron staggered backwards, spitting teeth and blood.
Thou art no longer a youth, Sir Mandarallan, he raged. Long hast thou used thy questionable reputation to avoid combat. Methinks it is time for thee to be truly tried.
It speaks, Mandarallan said with feigned astonishment. Behold this wonder, my lords and ladies, a talking dog. The court laughed at that. Let us proceed to the lower court, my lord of fleas, Mandarallan continued. Mayhap a pass at arms with so elderly and feeble a knight shall give thee entertainment.
The next 10 minutes were very long for the insolent young baron. Mandarallan, who could undoubtedly have split him down the middle with one stroke, toyed with him instead, inflicting numerous painful and humiliating injuries. None of the bones the great knight broke were absolutely essential, however, and none of the cuts and contusions were incapacitating. The baron reeled about, trying desperately to protect himself as Mandarallan skillfully peeled his armor off of him in chunks and pieces. Finally, apparently growing bored with the whole business, the champion of Arindia broke both of the young man's shin bones with a single stroke. The baron howled with pain as he fell.
"Prithee, my lord," Mandarallan chided, "modulate thy shrieks of anguish, lest thou alarm the ladies. Groan quietly, an it please thee, and keep this unseemly writhing to a minimum."
He turned sternly to a hushed and even frightened crowd.
"And," he added, "should any here share this rash youth's prejudices, let him speak now, ere I sheath my sword, for truly it is fatiguing to draw the weapon again and again."
He looked around.
Let us proceed then, my lords, for this foolishness doth weary me, and presently I shall grow irritable.
Whatever their views were, the knights of the royal court chose to keep them to themselves. Senedra gravely stepped out into the courtyard.
"My knight,"
she said proudly to Mandarallan. Then her eyes sparkled with mischief.
"I do perceive that thy prowess doth remain undiminished, even though cruel eld doth palsy thy limbs and snow down silvery hair upon thy raven locks."
"Eld?" Mandarallan protested.
"I'm only teasing, Mandarallan,"
she laughed.
"Put away your sword. No one else wants to play with you today."
They bade farewell to Mandarallan, Laldarin, and Relg, who intended to return to Taiba and their children in Meragor from Vomimbre.
"Mandarallan," King Anheg bellowed as they rode away from the city, "when winter gets here, come up to Val Alorn, and we'll take Barak and go boar hunting." "I surely will, your majesty," Mandarallan promised from the battlements.
"I like that man," Anheg said expansively.
They took ship again and sailed north to the city of Sindar to advise King Fulrak of the accords of Dal Perivor. Silk and Velvet were to sail north on Seabird with Barak and Anheg, and the rest of them planned a leisurely ride across the mountains to Algeria, and from thence down into the Vale. The farewells at Worf's side were brief, in part because they would all see each other again shortly, and in part because none of them wanted to appear over-emotional. Geryon took his leave of Silk and Barak in particular, with a great deal of reluctance. The two oddly matched men had been his companions for more than half of his life, and the prospect of being separated from them caused him an obscure kind of pain. The earth-shaking adventures were over now, and things would not ever really be the same.
"Do you think you can stay out of trouble now?" Beric asked him gruffly, obviously feeling the same way. "It upsets Meryl when she wakes up in the morning to find that she's been sharing her bed with a bear."
"I'll do my best," Geryon promised. "Do you remember what I told you that time just outside Winold, when it was so frosty that morning?" Silk asked. Geryon frowned, trying to remember. "I said that we were living in momentous times, and that now was the time to be alive to share in those events." "Oh, yes, now I remember. I've had some time to think about it, and I believe I'd like to reconsider." Silk grinned suddenly, and Geryon knew that the little man did not mean one word that he said.
"We'll see you at the Elon Council later this summer, Geryon," Onheg shouted across the rail, as Seabird prepared to depart. "It's at your place this year. Maybe if we work on it, we can teach you to sing properly."
They left the city of Sindar early the next morning and took the high road to Muros. Although it was not, strictly speaking, necessary, Geryon had decided to see his friends all home. The gradual eroding of their company as they sailed north had been depressing, and Geryon was not quite ready yet to be separated from all of them. They rode across Sindaria in late spring sunshine, crossed the mountains into Algeria, and reached the stronghold a week or so later. King Kohag was overjoyed at the outcome of the meeting at Khorum, and startled at the results of the impromptu conference at Del Perivor. Because Kohag was far more stable than the brilliant but sometimes erratic Anheg, Belgarath and Geryon went into somewhat greater detail about the astonishing elevation of Eriond.
"He always was a strange boy," Kohag mused in his deep, quiet voice when they had finished. "But then, this entire series of events has been strange. We've been privileged to live in important times, my friends."
"We have indeed," Belgarath agreed. "Let's hope that things quiet down now, for a while at least."
"Father," Hetar said then, "King Urquhart of the Murkos asked me to convey his appreciation to you." "You met the Murko king? And we are not at war?"
Kohag was amazed.
"Urquhart is not like any other Murko you have ever met, father," Hetar told him. "He wanted to thank you for killing Tar Urgas."
"That is a novel sentiment coming from a son,"
Geryon explained Urgut's peculiar background, and the normally reserved king of Algeria burst out in peal after peal of laughter.
"He knew Prince Keldar's father. That's exactly the kind of thing he would have done."
The ladies were gathered about Geryon and about Adara's growing brood of children. Geryon's cousin was at the ungainly stage of her pregnancy, and she sat most of the time now with a dreamy smile on her face as she listened to the inexorable changes nature was imposing on her body. The revelation of the dual pregnancies of Tsenedra and Polgara filled Adara and Queen Silar with wonder, and Poledra sat among them, smiling mysteriously. Poledra, Geryon was sure, knew far more than she was revealing. After about 10 days, Durnik grew restless.
"We've been away from home a long while, Paul," he said one morning.
There's still time to put in a crop. And I'm sure we'll need to tidy up a bit, mend fences, check the roof, that sort of thing.
Anything you say, dear,
she agreed placidly. Pregnancy had notably altered Polgara. Nothing seemed to upset her now. On the day of their departure, Geryon went down to the courtyard to settle Chrétien. Although there were plenty of Algar clansmen here in the stronghold who would have been more than willing to have performed the task for him, he feigned a desire to attend to it himself. The others were engaged in extended farewells, and Geryon knew that about one more goodbye right now would probably reduce him to tears.
That's a very good horse, Geryon.
It was his cousin Adara. Her face had the serenity that pregnancy bestows upon women, and looking at her convinced Geryon once again just how lucky Hetar really was. Since he had first met her, there had always been a special bond and a special kind of love between Geryon and Adara.
Zakath gave him to me, he replied.
If they confined their conversation to the subject of horses, he was fairly certain that he would be able to keep his emotions under control. Adara, however, was not there to talk about horses. She put one hand gently to the back of his neck and kissed him.
Farewell, my kinsman,
she said softly.
Goodbye, Adara, he said,
his voice growing thick.
Goodbye.
Chapter 28 King Belgarion of Riva, Overlord of the West, Lord of the Western Sea, Godslayer, and general all-around hero, had an extended argument with his co-ruler, Queen Saenedra of Riva, Imperial Princess of the Tolnedran Empire, and Jewel of the House of Barun. The subject of their discussion hinged on the question of just who should have the privilege of carrying Crown Prince Garen, heir to the throne of Riva, hereditary keeper of the orb, and until recently, the Child of Dark. The conversation lasted for quite some time as the royal pair rode with their family from the stronghold of the Algars to the Vale of Aldur. Ultimately, albeit somewhat reluctantly, Queen Saenedra relented. As Belgarath the sorcerer had predicted, Queen Saenedra's arms had, at last, grown tired of continually carrying her young son, and she relinquished him with some relief.
"Make sure he does not fall off,"
she warned her husband. "Yes, dear," Geryon replied, settling his son on Chrétien's neck just in front of the saddle.
"And don't let him get sunburned."
Now that he had been rescued from Zandramos, Geryon was a good-natured little boy. He spoke in half-phrases, his small face very serious, as he tried to explain things to his father. Very importantly, he pointed out deer and rabbits as they rode south, and he dozed from time to time, resting his blonde, curly head against his father's chest in absolute contentment. He was restive one morning, however, and Geryon, without really thinking about it, removed the orb from the pommel of his sword and gave it to his son to play with. Geryon was delighted, and with a kind of bemused wonder, he held the glowing jewel between his hands to stare with fascination into its depths. Often he would hold it to his ear to listen by the hour to its song. The orb, it appeared, was even more delighted than the little boy.
"That's really very disturbing, Geryon," Belden chided. "You have turned the most powerful object in the universe into a child's plaything."
"It's his, after all. Or it will be. They ought to get to know each other, wouldn't you say?"
"What if he loses it?"
"Belden, do you really think the orb can be lost?"
The game, however, came rather abruptly to an end when Poledra reined in her horse beside the Overlord of the West.
He is too young to be doing this sort of thing, Geryon.
She said reprovingly. She reached out her arm, and a curiously twisted and knotted stick appeared in her hand.
Put the orb away, Geryon. Give him this to play with instead.
That's the stick with only one end, isn't it? He said suspiciously, remembering the toy Belgarath had once shown him in the cluttered tower, the toy that had occupied Aunt Paul's mind during her babyhood.
Poledra nodded. It should keep him busy, she said.
Garen willingly gave up the orb for the new toy. The orb, however, muttered complaints in Garion's ear for the next several hours. They reached the cottage a day or so later. Poledra looked rather critically down from the hilltop above it.
You've made some changes, I see, she said to her daughter. Do you mind, mother?
Aunt Paul asked.
Of course not, Polgara. A house should reflect the character of its owner.
I'm sure there are a million things to do, Durnick said. Those fences really need attention. Well, I have hundreds of Algar cows in the dooryard if I don't mend them.
And I'm sure the cottage needs a thorough cleaning, his wife added.
They rode down the hill, dismounted, and went inside.
Impossible, Polgara exclaimed, looking about in dismay at the negligibly thin film of dust lying over everything.
We'll need some brooms, Durnick, she said.
Of course, dear, he agreed.
Belgarath was rummaging through the pantry. None of that now, father, Polgara told him crisply. I want you and Uncle Belden and Geryon to go out there and clear the weeds out of my kitchen garden.
What?
He demanded incredulously.
I will want to plant tomorrow. Open the ground for me, father.
Geryon, Belden, and Belgarath, rather disconsolately, went out to the lean-to where Durnick kept his tools. Geryon looked with a sense of defeat at Aunt Paul's kitchen garden, which seemed quite large enough to provide food for a small army. Belden gave the ground a few desultory chops with his hoe.
This is ridiculous, he burst out.
He threw down his hoe and pointed one finger at the ground. As he moved the finger, a neat furrow of freshly plowed earth moved resolutely across the garden. Aunt Paul will be angry, Geryon warned the hunchback.
Not if she doesn't catch us, Belden growled,
looking at the cottage where Polgara, Poledra, and the Riven Queen were busy with brooms and dustcloths.
Your turn, Belgarath, he said. Try to keep the furrows straight. Let's see if we can coax some ale from Paul before we rake it, Belden suggested when they had finished. This is hot work, even doing it this way.
As it happened, Durnick had also returned to the house briefly to refresh himself before returning to the fence line. The ladies were busily wielding their brooms, stirring up the dust, which Geryon observed stubbornly settled back on places already swept. Dust was like that sometimes.
"Where's Geryon?"
Tsinedra suddenly exclaimed, dropping her broom and looking around in dismay. Polgara's eyes went distant.
"Oh, dear," she sighed. "Durnick," she said quite calmly, "go fish him out of the creek, please."
"What?"
Tsinedra almost screamed as Durnick, moving rapidly, went outside.
"He's all right, Tsinedra," Polgara assured her. "He just fell into the creek, that's all."
"That's all?"
Tsinedra's voice went up another octave. "It is a common pastime for little boys," Polgara told her. "Geryon did it. Eriond did it. And now Garen's doing it. Don't worry. He swims rather well, actually."
"How did he learn to swim?"
"I haven't the faintest idea. Maybe little boys are born with the ability, some of them anyway. Geryon was the only one who tried drowning."
"I was starting to get the hang of swimming, Aunt Paul," he objected, "before I came up under that log and hit my head." Tsinedra stared at him in horror, and then she quite suddenly broke down and began to cry. Durnik was carrying Garin by the back of his tunic when he returned. The little boy was dripping wet, but seemed quite happy nonetheless.
"He's really very muddy, Paul," the smith noted. "Erion used to get wet, but I don't think he ever got this muddy."
"Take him outside, Zenedra," Polgara instructed. "He is dripping mud on our clean floor. Garion, there is a washtub in the lean-to. Put it in the dooryard and fill it." She smiled at Garin's mother. "It's about time for him to have a bath anyway. For some reason, little boys always seem to need bathing. Garion used to get dirty even while he was asleep." On one perfect evening, Garion joined Belgarath just outside the cottage door.
"You seem a bit pensive, Grandfather. What's the problem?"
"I have been thinking about living arrangements. Poledra's going to be moving back into my tower with me."
"So?"
"We are probably going to become involved in a decade or so of cleaning and hanging window curtains. How can a man look out at the world with window curtains in his way?"
"Maybe she won't make such an issue of it. Back on Perivore, she said that wolves aren't as compulsively tidy as birds are."
"She lied, Garion. Believe me, she lied."
Two guests rode up a few days later. Despite the fact that it was almost summer now, Yarblek still wore his shabby felt overcoat, his shaggy fur hat, and a disconsolate expression. Vella, the overwhelmingly sensual Nadrek dancer, wore her usual tight-fitting black leather.
"What are you up to, Yarblek?" Belgarath asked Silk's partner. "This wasn't my idea, Belgarath. Vella insisted."
"All right,"
Vella said in a commanding voice.
"I haven't got all day. Let's get on with this. Get everybody out of the house. I want witnesses to this."
"What exactly are we witnessing, Vella?"
Zenedra asked the dark-haired girl.
"Yarblek's going to sell me."
"Vella!"
Zenedra exclaimed, outraged.
"That's revolting."
"All bother that,"
Vella snapped. Bother was not precisely the word Vella used. She looked around.
"Are we all here?"
"That's everybody," Belgarath told her.
"Good."
She slid down from her saddle and sat cross-legged on the grass.
"Let's get down to business. You, Belden, or Feldegast, or whatever you want to call yourself. One time back in Meloria, you said you wanted to buy me. Were you serious?"
Belden blinked.
"Well," he floundered. "I suppose I was, sort of."
"I want a yes or a no, Belden,"
she said crisply.
"All right then, yes. You're not a bad-looking wench, and you curse and swear rather prettily."
"Good. What are you prepared to offer for me?"
Belden choked, his face going suddenly red.
"Don't dawdle, Belden. We haven't got all day for this. Make Yarblek an offer."
"Are you serious?"
Yarblek exclaimed.
"I've never been more serious in my life. How much are you willing to pay for me, Belden?"
Well, Yarblek protested. "This is absolute nonsense."
"Shut up, Yarblek. Well, Belden, how much?"
"Everything I own," he replied.
His eyes filled with a kind of wonder.
"That's a little unspecific. Give me a number. We can't haggle without a number."
Belden scratched at his matted beard.
"Belgarath," he said, "have you still got that diamond you found in Maragor that time before the Tol Nedran invasion?"
"I think so. It's somewhere in my tower, I believe. So's half the clutter in the world."
"It's in the bookcase on the south wall," Poledra supplied, "behind the rat-chewed copy of the Darin Codex."
"Really?" Belgarath said.
How did you know about that?
Remember what Siratus called me at Rehon?
The woman who watches?
Does that answer your question?
Would you lend it to me?
Belden asked his brother. I suppose give would be a better word. I doubt that I'll ever be in a position to repay you.
Certainly, Belden, Belgarath said. I wasn't really using it anyway.
Could you get it for me?
Belgarath nodded, and then he concentrated, holding out his hand. The diamond that suddenly appeared in his hand was almost like a chunk of ice, except that it had a definite pinkish cast to it. It was also somewhat larger than an apple.
Tareg's teeth and toenails,
Yarblek exclaimed.
And what the two of you, consumed with greed though you may be, consider this trifling thing a suitable price for this beguiling wench. You're both so set on selling,
Belden said, lapsing into Feldegast's brogue and pointing at the stone resting on Belgarath's hand.
It's worth 100 times more than has ever been paid for any woman since time began,
Yarblek said in an awed tone.
Then that ought to be about the right price,
Vela said triumphantly.
Yarblek, when you get back to Garog Nadrak, I want you to spread that word around. I want every woman in the kingdom for the next 100 years to cry herself to sleep every night just thinking about the price I brought.
You're a cruel woman, fella,
Yarblek grinned.
It's a question of pride, she said,
tossing her blue-black hair.
There, now. That didn't take too long at all, did it?
She rose to her feet and dusted off her hands.
Yarblek,
she said,
have you got my ownership papers?
Yes.
Get them, and sign me over to my new owner.
We have to divide up the price first, Vala.
He looked mournfully at the pink stone.
It's really going to be a shame to split that beauty, he said.
Keep it,
she said indifferently.
I don't need it.
Are you sure?
It's yours. Get those papers, Yarblek.
Are you really sure about all this, Vela?
He asked her again.
I've never been more sure of anything in my life.
But he's so ugly. Sorry, Belden, but it's the truth. Vela, what could possibly have made you choose him?
Only one thing, she said.
What's that?
He can fly.
Her tone was filled with a kind of wonder. Yarblek shook his head and went to his saddlebag. He brought back the ownership papers and signed them over to Belden.
And what would I be wanting with these?
Belden asked. The brogue, Geryon realized, was a way to hide emotions so deep that the hunchback was almost afraid of them.
Keep them, or throw them away,
Vela shrugged.
They don't have any meaning for me anymore.
Very well, then, me darling, he said.
He crumpled the papers up into a ball and held the ball out on the palm of his hand. The wad of paper burst into flame and burned down to ashes.
There, he said, blowing the ashes away. Now they won't be troubling us any more. Is that it? Is that all there is to it?
Not quite, she said.
She bent and removed the two daggers from her boot tops. Then she took the other two from her belt.
Here,
she said, her eyes now very soft.
I won't be needing these anymore.
She handed the daggers to her new owner.
Oh,
Palgara said, her eyes filling with tears.
What is it, Paul?
Durnick asked, his face filled with concern.
That is the most sacred thing a Nadrak woman can do,
Palgara answered, touching at her eyes with the hem of her apron. She just totally surrendered herself to Belden. That's just beautiful.
And what would I be needing knives for? Belden asked with a gentle smile.
One by one he tossed the daggers into the air, where they vanished in little puffs of smoke. He turned.
Goodbye, Belgarath, he said to the old sorcerer. We've had some fun, haven't we?
I have enjoyed it.
Belgarath had tears in his eyes.
And Durnik? Belden said. It looks as if you're here to replace me.
You talk like a man about to die, Durnik said.
Oh, no, Durnik. I'm not going to die. I'm just going to change a bit. You two say goodbye to the twins for me. Explain things to them. Enjoy your good fortune, Yarbleck. But I still think I got the better of that bargain. Garion, try to keep the world running.
Arion's supposed to take care of that.
I know, but keep an eye on him. Don't let him get into trouble.
Belden did not say anything to Synhedra. He simply kissed her rather noisily. Then he also kissed Poledra. She regarded him fondly, her golden eyes filled with love.
Goodbye, old cow, he said at last to Polgra,
slapping her familiarly on the bottom. He looked meaningfully at her waist.
I told you that you were going to get fat if you kept eating all those sweets.
She kissed him then, with tears in her eyes.
And now, mate Arlen, he said to Vella, let's be walking a bit apart. There's much to be said before we leave.
Then the two of them walked hand in hand up toward the top of the hill. When they reached it, they stopped and spoke together for a while. Then they embraced and exchanged a long, fervent kiss. And then, while they were still locked in each other's arms, they shimmered and seemed to almost dissolve. The one hawk was familiar. The bands on his wings were electric blue. The other hawk, however, had lavender bands on her wings. Together, they thrust themselves into the air and rose in an effortless spiral, up and up through the glowing air. Higher and higher they spun in that formal wedding dance, until they were no more than a pair of specks winging up and out over the veil. And then they were gone. Never again to return. Garion and the others remained at the cottage for another 2 weeks. Then, noting that Polgra and Durnik were beginning to show signs of wanting to be alone, Poledra suggested that the rest of them go on to the Vale. Promising to return that evening, Garion and Synhedra took their son and the nearly grown wolf pup and accompanied Belgarath and Poledra down into the heart of the Vale. They reached Belgarath's familiar squat tower about noon, and started up the stairway to the circular room at the top.
"Watch that step," the old man said absently as they climbed.
This time, however, Garion stopped, letting the rest go on ahead. He reached down, heaved up the stone slab that was the step, and looked under it. A round stone about the size of a hazelnut lay under the slab. Garion removed the stone, put it in his pocket, and replaced the slab. He noticed that the other steps were worn in the center, but this one was not, and he wondered just how many centuries, or eons, the old man had been stepping over it. He went on up, feeling rather pleased with himself.
"What were you doing?" Belgarath asked him.
"Fixing that step," Garion replied. He handed the old man the round pebble. It was rocking because this was under it. It's steady now.
I'm going to miss that step, Garion, his grandfather complained.
He stared at the pebble, frowning.
Oh, now I remember.
I put this under the step on purpose.
Whatever for?
Zenedra asked him. It is a diamond, Zenedra. Belgarath shrugged. I wanted to find out how long it would take to grind it down to powder.
A diamond?
She gasped, her eyes widening. You can have it, if you'd like, he said, tossing it to her. Then, taking into account her Tol Nedran heritage, Zenedra performed an act of sheer unselfishness.
No thanks, Belgarath. I would not want to separate you from an old friend. Geryon and I can put it back where it was when we leave.
Belgarath laughed. Geryon and the young wolf were playing together near one of the windows. There was a fair amount of mauling involved in their play, and the wolf was cheating outrageously, seizing every chance to lick Geryon's neck and face, which always sent the little boy into uncontrolled giggling. Poledra was looking around at the cluttered circular room.
It's good to be home, she said.
She was fondly caressing the back of the owl-clawed chair.
I spent almost 1,000 years perched on this chair, she told Geryon.
What were you doing, grandmother?
Zenedra asked her. Zenedra had begun, perhaps without realizing it, to mimic Geryon's customary forms of address.
Watching him, the tawny-haired woman replied. I knew that eventually he'd get around to noticing me. I didn't really think it would take him all that long, though. I really had to do something out of the ordinary to get his attention.
Oh?
I chose this form,
Poledra said, touching one hand to her breast.
He seemed more interested in me as a woman than he did when I was an owl or a wolf.
There was something I always meant to ask you, Belgarath said. There weren't any other wolves around when we met. What were you doing out there?
Waiting for you.
He blinked.
You knew I was coming?
Of course.
When was that?
Zenedra asked.
Just after Torak stole the orb from Aldur, Belgarath replied, his mind obviously on something else. My master had sent me north to advise Balar of what had happened. I took the form of the wolf to make better time. Poledra and I met somewhere in what is now northern Algeria. He looked at his wife. Who told you I was coming?
No one had to tell me, Belgarath. I was born, knowing you would come some day. You certainly took your time about it, though.
She looked around critically.
I think we should tidy up a bit here, she suggested. And those windows definitely need some curtains.
See, Belgarath said to Geryon.
There were kisses and embraces and handshakes and a few tears, although not really very many of those. Then Zenedra picked up Geryon and Geryon the wolf, and they started down the stairs.
Oh, Geryon said when they were halfway down. Give me the diamond. I'll put it back where it belongs.
Wouldn't an ordinary pebble work just as well, Geryon?
Her eyes were suddenly calculating. Zenedra, if you want a diamond so badly, I'll buy you one.
I know, Geryon, but if I keep this one, I'll have two.
He laughed, firmly took the diamond from her tightly clenched little fist, and returned it to its place under the step. They mounted their horses and rode slowly away from the tower in the bright sunshine of a spring noon. Zenedra held Geryon, and the wolf scampered alongside, dashing out from time to time to chase rabbits. After they had gone a little way, Geryon heard a familiar whisper of sound. He reined Gretchen in.
Zenedra, he said, pointing back at the tower. Look!
She looked back.
I don't see anything.
Wait. They'll be out in a moment.
They?
Grandmother and grandfather. There they come now.
Two wolves bounded out through the open door of the tower and ran across the grassy plain, matching stride for stride as they ran. There was a kind of unbridled freedom and an intense joy in the way they ran.
I thought they were going to get started with the cleaning,
Tenedra said.
This is more important, Tenedra. Much, much more important.
They reached the cottage just as the sun was going down. Durnik was still busy in the fields, and they could hear Polgara singing softly in the kitchen. Tenedra went inside, and Geryon and the wolf crossed the field to join Durnik. The meal that evening consisted of a roast goose and everything that went with it. Gravy, dressing, three kinds of vegetables, and freshly baked bread, still hot from the oven and dripping with butter.
"Why'd you get the goose, Paul?" Durnik asked.
"I cheated,"
she admitted calmly.
"Paul!"
"I'll explain it some other time, dear. Let's eat before it all gets cold."
After supper, they sat near the fire. They didn't really need a fire. Indeed, the doors and windows were even open. But fire and hearth were a part of home, sometimes necessary, even when not, strictly speaking, needed. Polgara held Geryon, her cheek against his curls, and a dreamy look of contentment on her face.
"Just practicing," she said quietly to Tenedra.
"There's no way you could ever forget that, Aunt Paul. You have raised hundreds of little boys,"
said the Riven Queen.
"Well, not quite that many, dear. But it never hurts to keep one's hand in."
The wolf lay sound asleep on the hearth before the fire. He was making small yipping noises, however, and his feet were twitching.
"He's dreaming," Durnik smiled.
"I wouldn't be surprised," Geryon said. "He spent the whole time while we were coming back from Grandfather's Tower chasing rabbits. He didn't catch any, though. I don't think he was really trying."
"Speaking of dreaming," Aunt Paul said, rising to her feet, "you two and your son and your puppy will want an early start in the morning. Why don't we all go to bed?"
They arose at first light the next morning, ate a hearty breakfast, and then Durnik and Geryon went out to saddle the horses. The farewells were not prolonged. There was no real need for extended farewells among these four, because they would never really be apart. There were a few brief words, a few kisses, and a gruff handshake between Durnik and Geryon, and then the Riven King and his family rode up the hill. Halfway to the top, Tenedra turned in her saddle.
"Aunt Paul,"
she called.
"I love you."
"Yes, dear," Polgara called back. "I know. I love you too."
And then, Geryon led the way on up the hill and toward home. Epilogue. It was mid-autumn. The Elorn Council had taken place at Rheda late that summer, and it had been boisterous, even rowdy. It had been attended by many who would not normally have been present. Non-Elorn rulers and their queens had virtually outnumbered the Elorn monarchs. Ladies from all over the West had descended upon Tenedra and Polgara, showering them with congratulations, and young children had gathered about Geryon, attracted by his sunny disposition, and by the fact that the little boy had somehow discovered a long unused route to the pastry kitchen, and all the treasures contained therein. If the truth were to be known, there was very little in the way of business conducted that year. And then, as always, a series of late summer storms announced that the meetings were at an end, and it was time for the visitors to begin thinking seriously about going home. This had always been the advantage of holding the council in Rheda. Although guests might prefer to linger,
The steady march of the seasons persuaded them that it was time to depart. Affairs had settled down in Riva. There had been a wild celebration when the king and his wife had at last returned with Crown Prince Garin, but no people, no matter how emotional, could celebrate forever, and after a few weeks things had returned to normal.